Good afternoon. You're listening to KUCB 89.7 FM on Alaska. I'm Hope McKenney, and I'm here in the studio with our arts and culture reporter, Maggie Nelson, who just finished up her final days of quarantine at home. It's nice to have you back, Maggie.
Hi, Hope. I'm happy to be back on the island and back in the studio.
So the coronavirus pandemic has certainly made this a year of unprecedented events. Unprecedented being a word we've used a lot here in the KUCB newsroom. And for the community of Unalaska, it's also been a pretty tough and tragic year.
Yeah, it certainly has. And even after enduring unthinkable tragedies, one after the other, it's been inspiring to see and have the chance to report on the ways this community has come together to support one another.
While it's been difficult, I agree, it has definitely been a pleasure to have the support of the community and to provide comprehensive news coverage during these strange times. Thank you all for joining us. For the next hour, we'll be taking a look back at Unalaska's most noteworthy stories of 2020. And while I wish we could begin on a positive note, 2020 rang in on a dim and distressing one. Exactly a year ago, on New Year's Eve, the FV Scandies Rose sank about 170 miles west of Kodiak Island while on its way to fish for Pacific cod. Two fishermen were rescued wearing Gumby survival suits in a life raft. The other five crew members and their 130-foot crab boat were never found. The search for the other crew members spanned over 20 hours, 1,400 square miles, and included four helicopter crews, two airplane crews, and the Coast Guard cutter Mellon. I sat down with survivor Dean Gribble Jr. to hear his account of the experience. Here's a clip from our conversation. A note to listeners, this story contains intense descriptions of the sinking.
Screaming at these other guys, I'm screaming at them to get out of the boat, and they were trying. I was trying to find something to throw back in so they could use it maybe to climb out. I couldn't find anything because everything was so icy. I couldn't get anything. The boat was going down.
A glimmer of hope was breaching the horizon following the tragedy of the Scandies Rose when the city of Unalaska decided to move forward with renovations to the public library, a project that had been on the city's capital and major maintenance plan for 5 years. The project came in $3.2 million over the estimated and budgeted amounts. And while some councilors expressed concern, overall, city council voted 5-1 to continue with the project. Here's Vice Mayor Dennis Robinson.
As I stated earlier, this is a hard pill to swallow, being so much over budget, pretty concerned about it. But I'm going to support it. And the reason I'm going to support it is that this is a project that helps the people.
A construction company was selected for the project, and the city began moving forward. However, as Hope later reported in April, the coronavirus pandemic would halt those plans and ultimately cancel the library renovation. Shortly after the library renovation project was approved, about halfway through January, a LifeMed medevac plane crashed off the runway at the Unalaska Airport on its takeoff as it was heading to ADAC to medevac a patient. No patients were on board at the time, but all three people who were, the pilot, a paramedic, and a nurse, were rescued with no injuries. An NTSB investigation was initiated to determine the cause of the crash, and thus became the second of two ongoing NTSB investigations regarding plane crashes on Unalaska's runway, the first being that of the fatal crash of a Saab 2000 in October of 2019. Following the LifeMed crash, Hope spoke with the chief of the NTSB's Alaska Regional Office, Clint Johnson, who said that weather may have been a contributing factor, but it was too early to come to a conclusion.
We don't speculate. We're very factual in our investigations, and that's exactly what we're going to do here. We have ways to go on this and still a lot of work to do and not drawing any conclusions at this point.
And the disasters didn't stop there. February 2020 was likely Unalaska's most tragic month of the year. The community saw the unexpected and painful loss of two young Unalaskans that month, Alexis Magalong and Trey Henning. Alexis, an 18-year-old high school senior, died of hypothermia near Summer Bay after her car got stuck in a vicious winter storm. Following her passing, hundreds of her relatives, friends, and community members gathered to celebrate her life.
I've never seen someone, especially someone so small, eat all that food. Like, even the rice and beans, everything on the about her, me and my friends, they know someone who's a super greedy. someone is never easy, but being surrounded by family, friends, and a community as supportive as on Alaska definitely makes it hurt a little less. It is important that we don't let this sad time in our lives weigh us down, but do our best to lift each other up and live our life to the fullest for Alexis. We all love and miss you so much, Alexis. I hope you are smiling down on us as we're gathered here to honor you and your memory.
Sadly, tragedy did not end with Alexis's passing. Just days after the community gathered to celebrate her life, 21-year-old Trey Henning was buried in an avalanche while snow machining near the quarry on Overland Drive. Trey was a mechanic at the city's Department of Public Works and had graduated from Unalaska High School in 2017. Less than a month after community members gathered for Alexis, hundreds of family and friends once again came together at the Unalaska High School gym, this time to celebrate the life of Trey. Here is a clip from his memorial service.
There goes my heart.
Growing up, I was always bigger than my little brothers, Trey and Seth and Blaine. When I left, left the island, all these guys were so small. And then I come back from the Marines and they're all bigger than me now. But it was really cool to watch everyone grow up, become their own independent person and whatnot. Now Trey's just going to be a memory, or, he's going to stay the same age for the rest of my life, and I don't get to see him grow up anymore.
I'd climb every mountain and swim every ocean.
He wasn't just my big brother, but he was a wrestling coach to me. I couldn't have done it without him. Now every time I step on the mat, I will wrestle in his name.
As the community continues to process these tragedies, people are encouraged to use local behavioral health resources and reach out for help. For those grieving, counseling and mental health services are available through the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association. Unalaskans can call APIA's helpline at 359-2743 to speak with a provider over the phone. Again, that number is 359-2743.
February was also reporter Laura Craigle's last month working for the station. She'd been with KUCB for more than 3 years and was planning to move back to Chicago to be with her family and eventually enroll in graduate school. Here's Laura reflecting on her time at KUCB.
That's the plan, to study journalism, get a little more training, get some more depth to my knowledge. So much of the amazing part of doing radio in Alaska, and specifically in a place like Unalaska, is that, the reporters, there's just a couple of us. We do so much. We get to learn on the job. We get to make it happen, figure it out, and do so many different things. So much of my knowledge and understanding has come from really wonderful, practical, on-the-ground experience. But I'm also looking to improve upon that.
We knew we would need some help in the newsroom after Laura left, so we hired Caroline Lester as an interim reporter, and she joined the team in February. In fact, it was a relief to have her at the time, as the coronavirus pandemic had just made its way to Alaska.
Well, I hadn't officially started working at KUCB. I imagine that the onset of the virus made things pretty difficult and created some unique challenges for the newsroom.
It definitely did. I think as a reporter, talking to people in person and reporting on events and tracking down city staff at City Hall is such a big part of the job. And all of a sudden that was taken away. So we began conducting interviews completely by phone, which can be difficult with our service in the Aleutians. And the majority of our coverage quickly shifted to the coronavirus. Even though the pandemic didn't really appear in Alaska until March, we had done some pandemic coverage previously. For example, in February, as concern regarding the virus was growing and a declaration of a global health emergency had been made by the World Health Organization, I covered the arrival of a commercial cargo vessel from China. Because of a 14-day federal quarantine order, the crew were unable to leave the vessel while in port. But following that, as the threat of the pandemic grew, clinic and city officials began to voice concerns about the pandemic pandemic reaching Unalaska, which is 800 air miles from the nearest hospital and at the time had only 3 ventilators on island. Caroline and I hosted a few call-in shows with clinic and city officials to talk about the virus and how Unalaskans could prevent the spread if it were to reach the island. Eventually, the city passed an emergency hunker down order in March, and concerns about how to enforce quarantines and health mandates, especially as they related to areas of industry, began developing. Here's Vice Mayor Dennis Robinson.
There are a few of them out there that probably need a little bit more aggressive urging to please respect our citizens here. And when they get off that plane, don't just go barging in the places and up the people. Be mindful of the distance. So maybe we can be a little bit more, send a little more aggressive letter that we pass this resolution out to all the companies that operate out of here.
It's kind of a trip to think back on that time. It seems so far away now. And while at the time it felt unprecedented and totally outlandish, now it feels almost like a part of everyday life.
I agree, and I think it was a really scary time for people, and nobody really knew what was going to happen back in March. I know as someone who is immunocompromised and is at high risk of complications from the virus, I immediately cut off contact with everyone. And a lot of Unalaskans, organizations, and businesses did the same. The schools also moved to home-based education around the same time, which was a huge transition for teachers, staff, students, and families on the island. In fact, that was also the time you started doing some work for KUCB, I think.
Yeah, so we were right on the cusp of closures and hunker down mandates due to the pandemic. So it was kind of a strange time to make the transition into radio journalism, something that was virtually brand new to me. I have a background in writing and teaching mainly, and have done a little bit of print journalism before, but as you very well know, I was about as green as could be when it comes to writing for radio. But everyone here at KUCB has been super helpful and has been very patient as I learned and started doing more coverage and even hosting newscasts.
And I think one of the first stories you wrote for KUCB was about the school's transition to home-based learning. And since then, covering the school district has actually become one of your beats. So let's check out a clip from that first story.
It's been a lot of just controlled chaos. How I've been taught how to teach and how I've been teaching for years is now just like completely turned upside down. You know, you're taught how to interact with kids and how to reach kids. And, you know, and now it's, okay, you can't see kids. So it's just trying to figure out how to best help them and how to best teach them, but also yet how to not overwhelm them.
Not only was the pandemic really gearing up and making some intense changes for Unalaskans, but that's also around the same time that Raven Air Group grounded its fleet and halted all commercial air service to the island.
This was actually a story Caroline and I worked on together at first. It was an unexpected and devastating change for the island. Unalaskans were left without any commercial flights for the first time since the fatal crash of last October. And flights were not the only thing being cut. With 20 cruise ship visits scheduled, Unalaska had been preparing for a record number of visitors this year. But the industry was dealt a series of blows in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic, and they canceled. Antuza Sejo, cruise ship coordinator for the Unalaska Visitors Bureau, said the loss of the scheduled visits was a blow to the city. But she said at least the community is not in the same dire situation as other coastal communities that rely more heavily on the visitor sector. Here's a clip from my conversation with Sejo.
It's going to be a loss of a lot of money for the bus company, the Unalaska Visitors Bureau, the Museum of the Aleutians, the World War II Center, Safeway, the RAT, the Grand, you know, all of this, all of these entities that make money when the cruise ships come, and even single individual artists who sell artwork are all going to be affected by this, but are fortunately for our community, it's not going to be a devastating blow like it is to somewhere like Skagway or Ketchikan or even Juneau, where they're highly dependent on that cruise ship income.
Changes were happening across the board in Unalaska, like most places at the time, but not all were bad. Among the transitions, Unalaska also welcomed its new fire chief, Patrick Shipp, in April. It was a long-awaited appointment, as the position had been vacant since the previous October when Ramona Thompson was fired. When he was out of his 2-week travel quarantine, Hope sat down with Shipp to learn about his career and why he came to Unalaska. Here's a piece of their conversation.
Retired out in July, went to the farm, bought a bulldozer, started building lakes, and even got back on the same volunteer fire department that I'd started out on. My wife started travel nursing. And she really, really loved it. So I spent a lot of time with her traveling. So we went to about 8 weeks in Florida, spent New Year's in Key West. And it finally dawned on me, I'm not ready to retire. I'm 51 years old, I'm not ready. And we actually have two sons that are, one's in Anchorage in the Army, and one's in the Coast Guard in Homer. So we said, you know what, let's go, you know, our last hurrah. I probably have 5, 6, 7 years left of being a good, productive fire chief. And we saw in Alaska, we did a lot of research on the area, and this is where we decided we wanted to come and be part of this community. So here we are.
Before she left, Caroline also got to take a look inside Unalaska's quarantine and isolation facility that was put together by city officials and local fish processing companies. Here's Caroline.
Be housed separately from each other. Hansen says he's not familiar with any other facility quite like this. Seattle, for example, bought a hotel back in March to use as a quarantine site. Anchorage has turned two arenas into an emergency homeless shelter. But Unalaska's project appears to be one of the only free quarantine and isolation facilities funded through a public-private partnership in the United States.
UNICE led the project, but all major seafood processors were involved.
Springtime is normally a busy and bustling time around Unalaska, which carries over into the KUCB newsroom as we cover local events and broadcast high school sports. But that was a challenge for us this year. Not only were many events canceled or held entirely through virtual platforms, but we were also stretched thin as news about the pandemic continued to pile up and our interim reporter Caroline left the island. This year, we had to get creative, and I think we really stepped up to the challenge. With the help of the community and volunteers, we were able to provide various programs through KUCB as well as Channel 8 TV, such as story time with teachers and our city librarian Karen Kresh, fitness programs, and sing-alongs. And virtual events didn't stop us from bringing the community coverage. As the community came together to bring events into the homes of Unalaska, so did we. For example, when our annual Dockside Discovery Day went virtual, reaching over 7,000 people across the nation, we were there virtually to make sure the community knew about it and also had the chance to participate. Here's a clip of Maggie's story about the virtual Dockside event.
An old scuba diver enjoying watching from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hi, from Somerville, Oregon. Enjoying this from Wisconsin. These are just a few of the comments on KUCB's live Facebook event for Dockside Discovery, which took place on Monday in Unalaska. From the docks of Dutch Harbor, the event reached over 7,000 people. For some, in the midst of coronavirus-related school closures and social distancing mandates, it was a refreshing reminder of their teachers' faces and voices. For others, tuning in from places like Minnesota, it was a chance to get a taste of a distant and enigmatic world.
Ooh, look at this. This is cool. So this is a seaweed. We call this one witch's hair. And someone asked previously, can you eat seaweed and is seaweed poisonous? We don't have any poisonous seaweed, but witch's hair produces sulfuric acid. It's the way it defends itself. So you don't want to eat witch's hair. You want to just leave the witch's hair there. That
was Missy. And when Unalaska's high school graduation was nearly canceled, but was saved and reconfigured into a parade, hope was there to capture the moment as the class of 2020 turned their tassels.
As a caravan of graduates led by officers from the Department of Public Safety made its way around the island in cars decorated with happy graduation messages in glittering gold, the seniors were greeted with cheers and waves from community members standing in their doorways and along the side of the road. And while graduates were permitted to walk in groups of five to pick up their diplomas, the three-part graduation ceremony was mostly virtual. In an effort to observe various health mandates that restrict social gatherings and proximity in the wake of the coronavirus. Despite the joy present during the graduation festivities, the class of 2020 has faced an incredibly difficult year. from losing a number of classmates to facing the effects of a global pandemic that canceled their prom, required them to learn from home for the past few months of their high school careers, and called for a graduation ceremony that was far from traditional.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Unalaska's first virtual graduation celebration. My name is John Conwell, and I'm honored to serve the community of Unalaska as the school district superintendent. Congratulations, class of 2020. Please know that despite the current disappointments of not being able to celebrate in person with your classmates, you will get through this together. And there will be brighter days ahead.
Then, when Unalaskans gathered together as social distancing drew them apart, Maggie jumped in line to chant with the group of local drummers who united and harmonized for hope.
The sun still sits high on the horizon in Unalaska, even though it's already 7 o'clock in the evening. As I adjust the audio levels on my microphone, a group of community members begin trickling in around the riverbank in the valley, kitchen utensils and drums in hand. It's an especially warm spring evening, and I'm energized by the eager and affectionate dialogue around me as these women greet one another, counting down to 7 p.m. 7 o'clock strikes. They scream with wild abandon and beat their drums enthusiastically. Slowly, the pounding fades into a soft heartbeat and hymnal chanting, and I sink into their energy as it becomes mesmerizing and soothingly overpowering. While Unalaskans worked hard to keep their spirits up during the pandemic, many people were anxiously anticipating the arrival of the virus to the island. And eventually, it happened when two Icicle Seafoods employees tested positive for the virus in early June. Luckily, the local processing plant was prepared and had enacted strict quarantine and testing protocol for arriving employees. And as city manager Aaron Reinders noted, the city partnered with the processing plant, the clinic, and the Department of Health and Social Services to help control the spread of the coronavirus.
We don't anticipate at this point to be raising our risk level here locally. Because, you know, these are identifiable cases, we're able to keep these individuals isolated, and our clinic is able to still maintain a standard of care for the community as a whole.
And the city remained at its medium coronavirus risk threshold for several months, despite large outbreaks on processing and fishing vessels such as the American Dynasty, as well as smaller outbreaks among crew members on the state ferry, the Tustamina.
And as the coronavirus continued to spread, global protests broke out over the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and the murders of countless other Black Americans before him. On May 25th, Floyd was killed by a white police officer who knelt on his neck for almost 9 minutes while he was handcuffed face down in the street. Hundreds of Alaskans turned out around the state in solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement. In Unalaska, over 100 community members gathered downtown in June to show support.
It's not right.
In this country, racism is the biggest problem that's not only killing African American people, but it's ruining America.
Silence equals violence.
I am here in honor of George Floyd, all those who died before him, and in hopes that none will die after him.
Things need to change, and it needs to change now.
The unjust killing of George Floyd, it was a tipping point for all the racial inequality that's been happening, all the racism that's been happening for many years.
The law enforcement, they're out of hand.
I think it's important that we support all people for justice.
I'm here because of the horrors of systemic racism that have built this country and sustained this country.
Every single victim of police brutality had people that cared about them and people they cared about. Every single one had plans for the future, and every single one was robbed of living their life.
It's enough. Oppression needs to stop. Racism needs to stop.
So we're here to say Black Lives Matter.
Over 100 Unalaskans lined the sidewalks in downtown Unalaska, holding signs stamped with messages saying Unungan against police brutality, justice for Floyd, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, and Black Lives Matter. They turned out to show their support for the many protesters standing for justice across the nation in the wake of the killing of George Floyd. Community member Carlos Tayag says he organized the demonstration to make sure Unalaskans are doing what they can locally, to make sure justice is served and people are treated humanely.
just because we are pretty far removed from a lot of the things that happen in communities outside of ours, doesn't mean that we're exempt from those things. We're a diverse community. We're Aleut, we're Asian, we're Black, White, we're African, we're Latino, we're European. And I don't think that anyone in this community is exempt from what's happening in the world.
Tayag says he doesn't believe a lot of the problems that plague the rest of the country affect the community of Unalaska, or at least to the same extent, but that it's still his responsibility to help shift momentum to change things. Beatrice Dietrich is standing on the roadside sporting a buoy that washed up on an Unalaska beach in her arms that reads Black Lives Matter oh so very much. There's another at her feet that reads Silence Equals Violence.
I'm here today because, well, honestly, this is an issue that I've been silent about for far, far too long, and there will never be enough that I can do to make up for that.
Dietrich came to the demonstration carrying her nearly two-year-old son, Nelson, on her back.
This is, you know, a starting point, and hopefully I will continue to make efforts to speak up for Black lives. And, you know, always on the top of my mind is setting a good example for my son.
As the coronavirus continues to sweep across the globe, and there's fear and uncertainty about how close to get to others and what to do in public, Dietrich says she's proud of the community for speaking up and joining together.
We've all gathered today, despite that, to speak up for an injustice that is impossible to ignore any longer. And as I mentioned earlier, I think a lot of us feel like there isn't possibly enough to do to really make up for that.
The sun is shining high in the sky as summer begins to make an appearance on the island. Unalaskans stand yelling and waving their signs in the air, encouraging drivers to honk as they slow down at the four-way stop downtown.
Just a week later, Unalaska discovered that half of its antiquated tsunami sirens weren't working. Hope dove into the story, not only examining the reasons why the tsunami sirens had failed, but also exploring what a tsunami warning looks like for Unalaska's seafood processing plants during a pandemic, who have hundreds of employees to evacuate to higher ground.
We received some positive feedback. Others have communicated some concerns. And, you know, we're working through the feedback that we received and trying to close the loop to make sure that we improve every time.
That's City Manager Erin Reinders. She wouldn't comment on which processing plants in Unalaska complained about the city's notification process during the evacuation. Some processing plants claimed that the city's unreliable message alerts and faulty tsunami sirens made quickly evacuating hundreds of employees from sea level to higher ground extremely difficult. While 4 out of 7 sirens aren't currently operational, Reinder said the city made sure to institute a multi-pronged approach to get word out to the community and processors. That approach included Nixol emergency alerts, tsunami sirens, and fire and police personnel driving through neighborhoods with sirens blaring and lights flashing. This summer also marked the worst year recorded for the sockeye salmon run at the McLees Lake Weir at Cape Wislow, located about 20 miles from Unalaska. Here's a look back at that story.
So on a typical sampling day, we'll open the gate. And we'll keep it open for an hour or two just to get as many fish in the trap as we can. And then we'll close the gate and Marisa will hop them to the trap and she'll wrestle one fish at a time.
That's Kanisha McGlashan-Price with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. She and Marisa Tovar spent nearly 2 months out in Wislow sampling and counting fish at the McLees Lake Weir, located about 20 miles from Unalaska in Reese Bay. Tovar is well-versed in the processes of collecting data at the weir. This is her second year doing the count in Wislow and 7th year in total, having worked other seasons in Kodiak and on the Alaska Peninsula.
And then we also have a trap set up in the middle of the weir where we lift a gate and try to get as many as we can for, we measure them, we tell if they're female or male, and we pl-
pluck scales as well so that biologists later in the year can go over and read them and be able to see how old the fish are and how much time they spent in freshwater and in saltwater.
This is McGlashan Price's first year in Wislow. She says she feels grateful to be spending 2 months counting fish because she knows how much this run means to the community of Unalaska and the Unungan people.
So I think it's really important to monitor the numbers each year so we can keep track and see that, you know, this year our numbers are way lower than they were 10 years ago, even 5 years ago. So the fact that we can keep track of the runs coming through can maybe shed some light to other topics such as climate change.
The Weir in Wislow has been in place since 2001, when local residents and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game became concerned that lack of reliable escapement estimates for salmon into McLees Lake could jeopardize the health of the run, as well as future opportunities for subsistence fishing. But for the last 2 years, Fish and Game was unable to secure funding to operate the weir, and there's no data on the strength of the salmon runs for the past 2 seasons or data on the health of their habitat. Shayla Shishnikov is camp coordinator with the Kowalungan tribe, which partnered with Fish and Game to apply for federal funding this year. Shishnikov, along with two interns and Kay Gumera, special projects assistant with the tribe, helped repair and rebuild the shelter and outhouse at the McLees Lake camp, which were in disrepair after the counter's 2-year absence.
For the past couple years, due to funding cuts, the fish weir hasn't been up and running. And that's a pretty important service for our community, especially our subsistence fishers who rely on red salmon for food. So we partnered with Fish and Game this year to not only provide...
And it wasn't the only sea life coverage that was happening over the summer. In July, Alaska state and local health officials began warning of dangerously high levels of toxins in shellfish after a person died of paralytic shellfish poisoning from mussels and snails in Unalaska. It was the first known PSP fatality in Alaska since 2010, although serious illnesses are reported more frequently, the state said. The state has recorded 4 previous PSP deaths in the past 30 years, in 1994, 1997, and 2 in 2010. Around the same time, a stellar sea lion died at Moore's Cove. Melissa Good with Alaska Sea Grant's Marine Advisory Program, along with 4 volunteers from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and the Museum of the Aleutians, performed a 4-hour necropsy, or animal autopsy, on the 1,500-pound male. In recent years, there have been more reports of stellar sea lions hauling out on beaches in poor condition. But scientists have been unable to retrieve the animals for research, largely because they're in remote areas, and therefore still don't know what's causing the increase in sick or injured animals. While a sad event in Unalaska, Good said the samples collected during the necropsy could help scientists find out why the largest of the eared seals are endangered in the Western Aleutians. And then, just a few weeks later, 2 dead whales washed up on Unalaska's shores, an adult fin whale and a juvenile humpback. While biologists said they hoped to determine the cause of deaths of both whales, because of COVID-19, they weren't able to. Here's a look back at my story.
There's the little humpback whale. It's floating right off the shore.
Unalaska typically sees about 1 dead whale wash up on its shores every year, according to Melissa Good, Alaska Sea Grant's marine advisory agent on the island. And when that happens, a team of biologists often perform a necropsy, or animal autopsy, on the whales to determine the cause of their death. But when both a fin whale and a juvenile humpback washed up on the island's shores in the past week, Good says they were unable to do the necropsy because COVID-19 prevented a large enough team from coming together to perform the task. Good says it takes a large team of individuals to do a whale necropsy, especially on a fin whale, which is the second largest mammal in the world.
So we weren't able to do a full necropsy. I was able to take a tissue sample, and that was skin and blubber, and we'll be able to look at the skin and get DNA work off of that. The blubber you can get some toxins from. So we'll have a small bit of information on this whale.
Good says they were looking for signs of human interaction with both whales, but didn't see any fishing lines wrapped around them or obvious signs of any scarring or cut marks due to an entanglement.
we could have missed something because we couldn't see the whole body, but there wasn't really anything obvious right up front. And that certainly doesn't eliminate other human interactions like vessel strikes or anything like that. So we just weren't able to get that close of a picture of it.
Although they chose not to in these cases, the Kowalungan tribe often harvests meat and blubber from whales that wash up on shore, which Good says could have provided a great opportunity to get samples to see if paralytic shellfish poisoning or other toxins were a factor in the whale's deaths.
After that, we could have gone in with a very small team and possibly gotten some samples as well that could have been telling. I would have been really interested in fecal samples or urine or stomach to look at if PSP was an issue in this case. That would have been, you know, some information we would have looked for and sought after. But we just didn't have that opportunity.
Last month, Alaska state and local health officials started warning of dangerously high levels of toxins in shellfish after a person died of paralytic shellfish poisoning from mussels and snails in Unalaska. And larger mammals could be affected as well. Good says she would have some concerns with people harvesting these two whales for subsistence because they don't know when or how they died. And she says because they were unable to perform a necropsy, they probably never will. But Good says it was a missed opportunity. She says while a dead humpback generally washes ashore once a year, she hasn't seen a dead fin whale since she took her position with Alaska Sea Grant 6 years ago. Although Unalaska is within their natural range, she says fin whales tend to stay offshore and don't generally come into the bay.
Outside of COVID area, we could have flown in a team, you know, that is a very experienced veterinarian team that would really help us get down and make sure we're collecting the right samples. And I know there's a lot of willing people here in the community that will step in and help out with the necropsies. The Kowalungan tribe would certainly step in and help with a necropsy. And so we have the people here that can do it. And so it was definitely a missed opportunity. But no matter what we do, human safety is always the number one priority.
The state pathologist says they will process the samples from the two dead whales to confirm things like species and sex, but that they will likely be unable to determine cause of death without a necropsy. In Unalaska, I'm Hope McKenney.
As summer began to wind down, teachers began preparing for the start of the school year, which would look far different from years past. I stepped into the classrooms of several teachers to get an idea of how they were preparing to teach students during the pandemic. Schools were reopening for the first time since they had been shuttered in March, and despite the extra work, the masks, and the social distancing that would come with the arrival of students this year, staff and faculty remained optimistic.
So you have to rethink things. You know, in the past, we might have shared a container of crayons in the group, and now everybody needs their own little set of crayons. Kind of like it was when I was going to school. So that was a long time ago. Golly sakes.
That was Darlene Jeppesen. She teaches second grade at Eaglesview Elementary School and says she's been teaching in Unalaska for about 30 years now. Jeppesen's classroom is filled with brightly colored and eye-catching books, blocks, posters, and mobiles. And there's a giant amethyst that she says used to have a large sign that read, "Please touch." Because she is trying to limit student contact with things in the room to help mitigate the spread of the coronavirus, Jeppesen says she had to remove the sign, and in place of some of her usual posters and decorations, Jeppesen was planning to hang signs that show students how to wash their hands or how to greet one another without touching.
Have a hug, or you can do like spirit fingers on the side, or yeah, a high five, you know, in the air, not touching each other.
Under its Smart Start 2020 plan, Unalaska schools will open to students under various COVID-19 mitigation regulations. Students are being asked to wear masks, desks are positioned 6 feet from each other, schedules for lunch and hallway access will be staggered, frequent hand washing will be encouraged, and various plexiglass barriers will separate students at lunch tables.
Schools will remain. Shortly after the start of the fall semester, a group of civil affairs officers, including Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii, a former Democratic presidential candidate, visited the island as part of a military mission. They came to assess Unalaska's future infrastructure needs, from its brimming landfill to its short runway and contaminated World War II sites to the poor internet connection here. It all started about 5 years ago when the Kowalungan tribe submitted an application to the military program for support. But the request went unanswered until early this year. While city and tribal officials and Native corporation executives aren't sure where exactly the project will lead, they said it could map a path forward to improving services and facilities on the island. The military made a report which they released in late September, which the city, tribe, and Unalashka Corporation are sifting through currently. They plan to see where their priorities align with the military's and have said they will present those findings to the community early next year. One of the priorities identified in the military report is promoting energy security through geothermal power production. The city signed a 30-year power purchase agreement with Unalashka Corporation China Power for 30 megawatts of geothermal-produced electrical energy from nearby Makushan Volcano. Officials from the U.S. Department of Energy said that if it's successful, Unalashka would be the first community in the nation completely powered by geothermal energy. OCCP co-founder Bernie Carl said he estimates that the project will begin operations in the final quarter of 2023.
And on September 1st, KUCB also began its partnership with ProPublica, an investigative journalism nonprofit. They selected former KUCB reporter Zoe Sobel to join their local reporting network, along with just five other public radio station reporters across the country. Zoe is investigating aviation safety across Alaska. KUCB General Manager Lauren Adams said it's a great learning opportunity for Zoe, as well as the rest of the station staff.
With ProPublica, we are taking one person and putting that person on a different beat and giving Zoe Sobel, in this case, a chance to really focus and learn. And I think she's going to really grow a lot as a reporter. And I think, you know, all of us as a station will learn a lot this year.
Meanwhile, Maggie followed Shayla Shishnikov, Camp Kungayu coordinator for the Kowalungan tribe of Unalashka, as she crafted her first ikyak, an Ununga skin-on-frame sea kayak, which she launched into Margaret Bay while the community watched from the shore.
Do you want to put those things up again, or should I just grab it?
You can just grab it.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm supervising. That is my job.
Mm-hmm. It is. Someone's got to do it.
Shayla Shishnikov is Camp Kungayu coordinator for the Kowalungan tribe of Unalashka and has just built and launched her first ikyak, an Unangak skin-on-frame sea kayak.
And so I am just really looking forward to getting this build in and to customizing this ikyak to me and my body. We are a water people. The water is just everything to us. It brings us food and life, energy and transportation and happiness, really.
Shishnikov crafted her ikyak over a span of about 14 days with the guidance of instructor Mark Daniels, a professional ikyak builder based out of California who has been crafting Aleutian sea kayaks for several decades, and help from Dustin Newman, youth services coordinator with the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association. Here's Daniels describing the beginning phases of the build.
The whole process starts with going out to the beaches and combing the shores for the right shapes of driftwood, because a lot of the parts in an ikyak are curved, but they have to be strong. So you select out, you take a pattern out with you, and you select out the pieces of driftwood that match and are the right type of wood and are in good shape.
From there, Daniel says, the process involves many long hours in the wood shop, then steaming and bending of the ribs as the ikyak begins taking on a three-dimensional shape. The process wraps up with the launch and blessing of the ikyak. When it is done at Camp Kungayu, the region's annual culture camp, which was canceled this year because of the COVID-19 pandemic, the ikyak is constructed in about 5 days. But for Shishnikov's build, as part of Daniel's apprenticeship program, they chose to slow things down. Typically, Shishnikov would travel to California as well to learn and build with Daniels in his workshop, but she says she was unable to travel there in March, as she'd previously planned to do, due to the pandemic. Shishnikov and Daniels collaborated with APIA and the Kowalungan tribe to move forward with the build by bringing Daniels to Unalashka despite the cancellation of the culture camp. And while things are happening on a different timeline and location, Shishnikov says she's excited to have the opportunity to build her own ikyak in her home community.
And I think that initial launch out to sea really sets you up for, you know, the rest of the course of your ikyak. So to be able to do that here in our Unangak waters and on our lands, I think is pretty significant.
For Shishnikov, the build is not simply a physical process, but also an emotional, cultural, and spiritual one. And for Dustin Newman, who has done a few Ikyak and other types of builds and joined Daniels to help guide Shishnikov, the construction is also about fostering mental well-being through cultural practices.
We have a value called Kayuktuchin, which is be strong. I tie that into that same ideology of you have to be strong mentally, physically, emotionally, and spiritually to get through tough times, and having your cultural awareness, having those values instilled in you really helps get through tough times.
It's a process of passion for Newman and Shishnikov, and also for Daniels, who has been building Ikyak and other Aleutian sea kayaks since the 1980s. When he describes the process and the structure, his enthusiasm is immediately apparent through his attention to detail and the audible excitement that carries through his voice.
The cleft, the two-part bow, and the truncated stern, the exact number of ribs, the exact dimensions of it, it's perfect. It fits the human body and makes a human being into a marine mammal.
He says he became obsessed with the Aleutian kayaks when he saw them in various museums. He started reverse engineering them and eventually was invited up to St. Paul in the Pribilof Islands to teach and build. Daniel says he feels privileged to help mend the gap of cultural knowledge that was created when the Unangak people were removed from their homes, many never to return.
And I feel like it feels really meaningful to be picking that stuff up and sort of mending that wheel and getting it back to where it's spinning again.
For the blessing of her Ikyak, Shishnikov says she is following Newman's lead. Like Daniels, Newman also approaches the build as a process that unites past and present.
Like mine personally, I'll embellish with our ivory carvings and circle dot motifs. Those circle dot motifs are those traditionally are what allow our ancestors to be with us. It invites them to be on the waters and dancing with us and everything. Today,
of course. At the launch of her vessel on Saturday night, Shishnikov included an ivory carving of a sea otter nestled into the inside of the Ikyak. And attached to the outside, near the head of the vessel, a humpback whale, Alamach in Unangam Tunu, a symbol that is particularly special to Shishnikov and is also her Unangak name. Reporting in Unalaska, I'm Maggie Nelson. September was probably one of my favorite months reporting for KUCB. I got to watch and learn as Shayla crafted her Ikyak, and I also got to go hiking with Jojo, who, for those of you who don't already know, is a cat, and a very charming one at that. Silently, crouched low to the ground, Jojo the hiking cat pursues me as I trek up Nirvana Hill. If it hadn't been for the long green and yellow reflective fringe and bell hanging from his collar, I would have had no idea how closely he trailed.
He's the best. Look at him.
That's Marisa Tovar, one of Jojo's owners and devotees. Tovar says Jojo is always free and never goes out on a leash. And while he's unsuccessfully tried to join her in the kayak, he prefers to stick to the tundra and hiking buddies rather than roaming into town on his own. Although Jojo didn't have a whole lot to add during the hike, he was generally distracted with cheekily avoiding my camera, stopping for water breaks along the creek, or stealthily sneaking up behind me, Tovar and her partner, Harish Wasavan, were excited to dote on their beloved Jojo.
He goes to people's house and he does this thing, Jojo spread, where he spreads himself, you know, like, you know, it's kind of funny to see it. I mean, you can't help it, like, you know, if he shows up like that, then you definitely, like, give something, you know.
He works it. He knows how to work it.
Wasavan and Tovar both agree that it's hard to deny Jojo when he spreads out on the ground, taunting you with the soft, white, contrasting inner side of his belly, a move they refer to as the Jojo spread. And as Tovar notes, it's a move he uses frequently to get treats and attention from many people in the area. She says that while he doesn't do much real hiking without a partner, he roams the neighborhood, making daily visits to old friends.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my God.
So he has a favorite neighbor that gives him tuna.
The fall brought another busy season for KUCB, with things like our first virtual and socially distanced pledge drive to local election coverage. And while election coverage remained fairly tame, this was your first year covering municipal elections, right?
It was, and we hosted a series of candidates forums, which were unique this year due to social distancing mandates, but were overall a great success, I think. There were two contested races on this year's ballot, City Council seat B and School Board seat B. For City Council seat B, incumbent Thomas Bell ran against Brenda Baker, and Fire Chief Patrick Shipp and Jolene Longo vied for School Board seat B. Bell was voted in for City Council, and Longo took the School Board seat. And originally, there were also two uncontested races on the ballot, one for City Council and the other for School Board. Incumbent Fernando Barrera ran unopposed and was re-elected to the School Board, whereas incumbent Dennis Robinson was challenged by write-in candidate Anthony Longo for City Council. In the end, Robinson defeated Longo by 94 votes. And as we moved further into the winter months, Raven Alaska finally returned. After months of talk about resurrecting the airline, a rebooted version of Raven Airlines began offering scheduled flights between Unalaska and Anchorage.
As the holidays approached, Unalaska confirmed its first case of community spread of COVID-19. But it wasn't until about 3 weeks after that that the island moved to its high coronavirus risk threshold, when two more cases of community spread were confirmed, and the city determined that there was potential widespread exposure to the virus on the island. Unalaska schools moved to remote learning, and council members voted to adopt a hunker-down order, which required people to stay at home as much as possible. Here's City Manager Erin Reinders.
What might be on many of people's minds at this point is how long do we remain at this high level? The key thing to remember is nobody wants to be here forever. And so according to our risk thresholds, once there are 2 weeks of no additional confirmed community spread cases in Unalaska, we can then make the consideration to step back down to the medium risk threshold.
On Tuesday, Unalaska lowered its local COVID-19 risk factor back to medium, following 2 weeks without a new case stemming from community spread, and the city council subsequently lifted the hunker-down order. Reinders said that Unalaskans need to remain diligent.
We need to continue doing all that we can individually to really limit that spread, because if we get into the case where there is widespread exposure or, you know, if there is another confirmed case of a community-acquired COVID-19 case, then we'll be right back to that high-risk level again. And that certainly is not a place where we want to be at all.
9 months after the coronavirus arrived in the state, Unalaska received its first round of the COVID-19 vaccine. The doses manufactured by drug company Moderna touched down around 1:30 p.m. last Tuesday on a Raven Alaska flight from Anchorage. They were rushed immediately to the island's clinic, and within a few hours, the first Unalaskans had received their shots. A group of frontline medical providers and emergency responders stand 6 feet apart in the after-hours area of the Aluluk Family and Health Services Clinic. Some are waiting to get the vaccine produced by drug company Moderna, and others are waiting to see if they have an allergic reaction before leaving the building. Dr. Meg Sarnecki is one of 20 people to get the vaccine Tuesday afternoon, just hours after it landed in Unalaska.
The injection feels the same as any other vaccine. A little poke in the arm, you're done. We watch you for 15 minutes. If you have any history of anaphylaxis or severe allergy, we'll be watching you for 30 minutes. And that's it. Easy.
Across the state, the first doses of the COVID vaccine are going to frontline hospital workers and residents and staff of long-term care centers like nursing homes. Next on the list are emergency responders and healthcare workers more generally. For Unalaska, that means the first round of vaccines are for providers at Unalaska's clinics, emergency responders who have direct contact with patients, as well as elders at Unalaska's senior center, says Melanie Tira, chief executive of the IFHS clinic.
We're not yet focused on individuals who are not directly interfacing with patients or can work remotely. Right now, it's really the direct interface providers.
Tira says the next vaccine shipment will reach beyond clinic settings to other providers in Unalaska, like chiropractors and physical therapists. Lori Jackson is a nurse practitioner and medical director for the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association, which operates the Tribal Community Clinic in Unalaska. She says the island opted to wait for the Moderna vaccine, which got federal emergency authorization last week and can be stored in a normal freezer. Another vaccine from drug company Pfizer was approved earlier, but it needs to be kept at ultra-cold temperatures, which meant that the Moderna version was a better fit for an Aleutian island 800 miles from Anchorage that's known for its inclement weather. Jackson says she's learned from problems getting other types of vaccines to Unalaska.
I already had frozen vaccines that in the last couple of weeks didn't make it out here. And that was just frozen vaccines. That wasn't ultra freeze, minus 70 to minus 90 that we are required for Pfizer.
Just last week, Ketchikan's... We will continue to cover this story as more vaccines arrive on the island, and we'll keep you updated about local measures and mandates as the city continues to evaluate its coronavirus risk levels. And in classic Aleutian fashion, as we wrap up the year, the collision of a warm, wet weather front with a mass of cold air from Siberia could set a new record, the lowest barometric pressure recorded in the North Pacific. Climate specialist Rick Toman says this could bring hurricane-force winds and high seas to the southwestern Bering Sea this week.
This storm is generating a lot of interest from weather watchers around the world because it is going to wind up, in all likelihood, being one of the deepest low-pressure systems that has ever been seen in the Bering Sea.
He said the storm, which is expected to reach Unalaska tonight, will likely dissipate as it crosses the eastern Aleutians and heads towards the Alaska Peninsula. For Unalaskans, he says, it'll likely feel like just another blustery winter day on the island.
Well, it was definitely a hectic and overall rather devastating year. But going back over everything this quickly kind of put things in a different perspective for me. Time seems to have just been spiraling this last year. And it's definitely been a challenge, albeit an engaging one, trying to come up with unique ways to continue to provide Unalaskans with comprehensive news coverage. It's been such an awesome experience working with KUCB staff and the wonderful community of Unalaska as I learn more and more about radio journalism.
And just to echo what Maggie said, it has been an incredibly hard year on this island and across the world. And I desperately hope with all my heart that we can bring you more uplifting stories in the coming year. I feel so grateful to report for and live in this incredible community. So thank you all so much for sticking with us.
And that concludes KUCB's 2020 Year in Review. Thank you everyone for tuning in. This program includes news contributions from reporters Laura Craigle, Caroline Lester, and Zoe Sobel. I'm Maggie Nelson.
And I'm Hope McKenney, and from all of us here at KUCB, Happy New Year. We appreciate your support in 2020 and look forward to bringing you the news and information that you rely on in the coming year.